They say the truth sets you free. But in my world, truth gets you fired, ghosted, erased. I wasn't born a liar. I was engineered into one. Taught to mirror desires, decode silence, and turn doubt into devotion. At first, I thought I was saving people, showing them the version of reality they wanted to believe. But then I met someone who told the truth. Every time. And that's when everything started to unravel. My lovers, my colleagues, my clients, they all started choosing him over me. So I did what any woman trained in psychological warfare would do. I watched. I seduced. I infiltrated. And then, on the night of his biggest live broadcast, I exposed him. But what I found on that stage wasn't just betrayal. It was a mirror. And staring back was the version of me I never wanted anyone to see. If you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. They say persuasion is an art, but for me, it started as survival. I was 23 the first time I realized people didn't want honesty. They wanted resonance, that sweet, dopamine-dripping moment when their biases were confirmed, when their wounds were kissed instead of cleaned. I was good at that. Too good. My name doesn't matter, not yet. In this world, identity is fluid currency. What matters is the role I played. Emotion engineer at a boutique behavioral startup in Manhattan's financial district. We didn't build apps. We built desire. We sold what couldn't be held. Influence. Fear. Lust. Redemption. All disguised as marketing. Most of my day was spent in a room with no windows, just screens. Live feeds. Facial recognition. Micro-expression tracking. I watched people cry to strangers, confess to algorithms, beg for digital absolution. And then I'd build campaigns that made them feel seen, but never safe. Safe people don't buy. Unsafe people click. There was a man once, my first project, who taught me just how deeply people crave to be misled. He was a hedge fund executive. Married. Powerful. Lonely in a way that screamed money but whispered shame. He booked our emotional realignment program thinking it would help him communicate better with his wife. I studied his gestures, his speech cadence, his pupil dilation when I touched his wrist. And then I gave him exactly what he thought he wanted. A story. A lie wrapped in data. A fable of who he could be if he just let go of the truth. He cried during the fourth session, not because he found himself, but because I convinced him that the version of himself his wife hated was never real. She left him. He thanked me. That's when I learned. We don't trust truth tellers. We envy liars who lie with purpose. My job evolved. I became more than a strategist. I became a symbol, the soft sell in stilettos. Clients began requesting me by name. I'd walk into pitch rooms like confessionals. Black dress. No notes. Just presence. And I'd tell executives exactly what they wanted to hear, but never in their words. I made them feel like it was their own epiphany. That's the key. Echo, don't argue. You don't manipulate by force. You manipulate by invitation. But it wasn't all business. After hours, I let myself indulge. Private rooftop lounges. Candlelit salon nights where art met ego. And lovers. Beautiful, broken men who mistook my intensity for intimacy. There was one, Julian. A data ethicist. French-American. Thick accent. Looked like Sin in a silk shirt. We met at a neuroscience and AI conference in Soho. He said he could smell deception on people. I told him I wore it like perfume. He laughed, leaned in, and whispered, "Then maybe I should wear you." That night, in a penthouse I didn't pay for, we collided. Bodies speaking louder than words. Control and surrender blurred. But even with him, I never let go. Because control wasn't a performance. It was my bloodstream. Until he arrived. Not Julian. Someone else. A truth teller. The first one I couldn't decode. The first man whose eyes didn't flicker, whose words didn't pivot, whose presence didn't beg to be understood. He was calm. Still. Dangerous. His name? I won't say it yet. Because the moment I did, everything in my world began to fracture. And I realized. I could manipulate anyone, except the man who didn't care if I did. His name was Cashin Vale. I remember it because it sounded like a lie. Too cinematic. Too clean. Like the kind of name someone makes up when they're about to disappear. We met on a Wednesday. I was speaking at a closed-door panel on emotionally optimized communication, the kind of tech industry circle jerk where executives pretended to care about ethics as long as it didn't interfere with quarterly earnings. Afterwards, he approached me. No handshake. No forced smile. Just a nod, and a presence that felt like an anti-mirror. Most people leaned into me, reflected my energy, tried to charm me. K. Cashin just observed. You speak as if truth is irrelevant, he said, voice low, almost dispassionate. Do you believe that, or do you just know it sells? I should have brushed him off. Mocked him. Redirected. But something about his posture, his stillness, made me pause. He wasn't posturing. He wasn't trying. He was certain. And certainty like that, it's either godlike or sociopathic. We met for coffee the next day. Public place. Neutral ground. I wore a wine-colored blouse and minimal makeup, enough to look composed, not performative. He wore black. Always black. No watch. No jewelry. No tech in sight. I don't own a smartphone, he told me. I prefer silence over surveillance. A red flag, maybe. Or maybe he was just smarter than the rest of us. We talked for hours about behavioral economics, persuasion bias, the ethics of AI-generated personalities. He quoted Jung. Then Camus. Then a meme. And somehow it didn't feel pretentious. The strangest part? I couldn't read him. I'd built my career on micromovements. Twitch of the jaw equals suppressed guilt. Extended eye contact equals dominance masking vulnerability. Leftward glance during recall equals fabrication or imagination. But Cashin? He was blank. Not in an empty way. In a controlled way. Like a machine built to withstand interrogation. When I teased him, he didn't flinch. When I flirted, he didn't lean in. I even tried touch. A brief graze of my fingers across his knuckles as I reached for the sugar. Nothing. But his pupils dilated. Just a little. He noticed my smirk. And said quietly, "You're testing me." I shrugged. "Wouldn't you if you were me?" He leaned forward, not to intimidate, but to level the field. "I don't play defense," he said. "And I never bluff. But if you want a game, choose your weapon carefully." That night I dreamed about him. Not in the way I expected. Not sex. Not even touch. Just a silent room. A single chair. Me, confessing to things I hadn't even admitted to myself. I woke up breathless. The next week he showed up at my office. No appointment. Just walked in during one of our internal presentations on predictive desire modeling. The interns thought he was a new consultant. I knew better. He sat in the back. Watched. Took notes in his head. Afterwards, I confronted him in the hallway. "You can't just walk in here. This is a secure floor." He tilted his head. Smiled slightly. "You didn't stop me. Neither did anyone else. Maybe you're not as in control as you think." I wanted to slap him. Or kiss him. Or both. Instead, I asked him out for drinks. That night, things changed. We sat in a dimly lit lounge, red velvet booths, jazz humming in the background, rain against the window like a metronome for my heartbeat. I leaned in. "Why me?" I asked. "Why all this attention?" He sipped his bourbon. Eyes steady. "Because you're not a liar," he said. "You're a storyteller who forgot her own ending." And with that, he leaned in and kissed me. Not with hunger. With precision. His lips traced mine like punctuation. A sentence I wasn't sure I wanted to end. But later that night, when we were alone, half undressed, bodies in tension like pulled wire, he stopped. Held my wrists gently. Looked me in the eye. "This isn't conquest for me," he said. "It's excavation. I want to see what you've buried." Then he walked out. Left me in my own bed, panting. Exposed. Unfinished. And that's when I knew. This wasn't a man to seduce. This was a man who saw through seduction. And that scared me more than anything. Because for the first time in my life, I didn't know how the story would end. Pleasure is a feedback loop. Stimulus. Response. Reinforcement. That's how we train the AI to model consumer behavior. To predict desire, even before the subject could articulate it. But I didn't realize I was becoming one of the test subjects. Not in a lab. In real life. In bed. With him. Cashin didn't pursue me like a man chasing a woman. He studied me like an artist staring at a sculpture buried in marble. And every night he chipped away at something I didn't even know I was hiding. He never touched me the same way twice. Sometimes it was soft, lips on my spine, hands like silk rope. Other nights it was urgent, teeth at my collarbone, his breath hot behind whispered commands. But always, always he pulled away before I could need him. He left me unfinished. On purpose. At first, I thought it was a power play. But then I realized it was programming. He was reconditioning me. Rewiring how I associated touch with trust. One night, after a brutal strategy session at the office, I came home exhausted. Kicked off my heels, dropped my coat, poured a glass of red. Something bold and overcompensating, like I was trying to taste control again. I turned on the lights. He was already there. Cashin. Sitting in the dark. Reading my old notebooks, the ones from my days in behavioral psych. I should have been furious, but I wasn't, because I was curious. You wrote this before you joined Viralapse, he said. Back when you still believed in truth. He held up a page. A quote I forgot I wrote. Desire is not about what we want. It's about who taught us to want it. His voice softened. You don't sell lies. You sell longing. He stood, walked over, didn't kiss me. Just traced my face with two fingers, one from each hand, down both cheeks. Like I was being split into two versions of myself. The one I was. The one he was uncovering. That night we didn't have sex. But something far worse happened. He told me something true. Something raw. And I couldn't tell if it was real or strategic. When I was 14, he said, lying beside me, my mother faked her death for 6 months to escape my father. I didn't know she was alive until she walked back in one day and acted like nothing happened. He looked at me. That's when I stopped trusting truth. It wasn't the lie that broke me. It was how easy it was to accept. I wanted to hold him, but he didn't want to be held. He wanted to watch me react. He wanted to observe what I would do with his vulnerability. And the worst part, I didn't offer comfort. I didn't even process it emotionally. I stored it, like ammunition, like a variable in the algorithm. And that terrified me, because I realized I wasn't falling in love. I was calculating it. A week later, my team presented the newest feature for our emotion mirroring app, an AI that could auto-adjust video content to maximize emotional resonance based on biometric viewer data. We called it the pleasure algorithm. Cashin heard about it through internal whispers. He showed up at our beta testing preview, watched the demo silently. Afterwards, in front of the whole room, he said, "This doesn't predict pleasure. It predicts manipulation tolerance. You're not serving people, you're soft conditioning them to crave deception." Silence. Even my boss was speechless. I smiled. "What's the difference, Cashin? People don't care if it's true. They care if it feels true." He smiled back. But it wasn't warmth. "Keep thinking that. One day, they'll turn on you the moment your illusion fails." That night, I kissed him like I wanted to make him bleed. I pulled him to the floor. Straddled him. Bit his lip until I tasted proof of conflict. He let me. Didn't resist. But before I could finish, before climax or control or collapse, he flipped me. Hard. Fast. Face to the floor. Breath knocked out. He whispered in my ear, "You're not the only one who knows how to map a nervous system." And then he left. And I realized something I wasn't ready to say aloud. He had accessed my algorithm. And I hadn't even known I had won. There's a moment, just before you lose control, when your body knows it's over before your mind does. My moment came inside what we called the echo room. Internally, it was just another research project. Externally, it was marketed as a corporate empathy simulator, an AI-driven chamber where executives could test their emotional reflexes under high-stakes, ethically charged scenarios. But in truth, it was a sandbox for psychological warfare. We designed it to replicate conversations with difficult partners, deceptive clients, manipulative lovers. It used live feeds, deepfake overlays, voice cloning, and predictive language engines to mirror your most personal weaknesses back at you. It was a mirror with its own consciousness. Cashin wanted to try it. He said he wanted to test the system. I told him it wasn't stable. He didn't care. "The most dangerous truths," he said, "are the ones that look like memories." I didn't know then that he wasn't talking about himself. He was talking about me. We entered the echo room together. Two headsets. Two chairs. A curved wall of reactive sound and LED panels. Cashin sat without hesitation. I followed, because I needed to know what he would do when his truth faced mine. The program booted, and the room became a temple of memory. The first scene? A hotel room in Berlin from 5 years ago. A memory I never told anyone. I was on assignment. I'd seduced a high-level exec for behavioral data. He told me he loved me. I let him believe it, just long enough to get what I needed. He killed himself 6 weeks later. I read about it on a scrolling ticker in Times Square. Cashin saw it all. He didn't flinch. He watched me flinch. "That wasn't manipulation," I said, trying to keep my voice from cracking. "That was professional misdirection." He laughed. "There's no such thing. There's only intimacy as weapon, or surrender." The next scene changed. Now it was Cashin. His father, storming into a childhood bedroom. His mother screaming behind a closed door. A young boy sitting on a bed, covering his ears, whispering a pattern, a survival algorithm coded in silence. And I realized, this wasn't his memory. It was mine. My father. My mother. My whisper. Cashin turned to me. Do you see now? This room doesn't echo your choices. It echoes your programming. I yanked the headset off. Breathing heavy. Skin clammy. Mind fractured. He removed his slowly, calmly, like a surgeon leaving an operating theater. You built this room, he said. But I own it now. I should have kicked him out. Should have screamed. Called security. Shut it all down. Instead, I said nothing. Because I knew he was right. That night, we didn't touch. We sat in silence in my apartment, lights off, the sound of traffic like static in the distance. I broke first. What do you want from me? Cashin turned to me, eyes unreadable. I want you to see what you are without your stories. Without your seduction. Without your software. I want the version of you that never had to lie to survive. Because that version? That's the one I'd trust. But there was a problem. That version didn't exist anymore. If she ever had. The next morning, I received an encrypted video. Sent anonymously. It showed me in the echo room, confessing things I never said aloud. But the audio was edited, twisted, spliced to make me sound like a villain, a manipulator, a sexual predator weaponizing truth for profit. And it had Cashin's name on the file. I confronted him at his flat. Stormed through the door. Slammed the file on the table. What the hell is this? He didn't deny it. Didn't even blink. A test, he said. One you failed. You trusted the room more than me. I stared at him, shaking. You made me think I was healing. He stepped forward. You were. But healing and breaking feel the same in the beginning. I slapped him. Not hard. But not soft, either. He let it happen. And then, without a word, he pulled me in. Held me. Tight. Too tight. And we fell into bed, not out of lust but desperation. We didn't make love. We didn't fuck. We collapsed into each other. Two systems crashing, code tangled, hearts short-circuiting. And when it was over, he whispered, "You're not the only one who weaponized intimacy. They say if you want to control someone, learn their secrets. But if you want to own them, make them believe they don't have any." 3 days passed after the collapse. Cashin had vanished. No calls. No messages. No familiar silhouette in the building lobby. Just silence. The kind of silence that doesn't feel like absence. It feels like observation. And that's when I noticed the glitch. My smartwatch vibrated at 3:17 a.m. No notification. No app. Just a pulse. I checked the logs. Empty. Then my apartment lights blinked just once. Like a heartbeat. And my screen lit up. Device pairing complete. I hadn't paired anything. But something someone had paired with me. I ran a scan on the network. The result? 3 clone data pathways. One traced back to Cashin's encrypted server. The other 2. Internal. Viralab's corporate grid. My own company had been watching me. Not just watching, recording, storing, analyzing. I broke protocol and hacked the backend using an obsolete dev admin key I wasn't supposed to have anymore. What I found? A dossier. On me. Labeled, Subject 3. Cassandra model prototype. Video footage. Transcripts. Biometric logs. Even my voice, sliced into fragments. Remixed into corporate training prompts. Use emotional latency to extend perceived empathy. Disrupt certainty with subtle erotic tension. Never speak first. Let them lean in. It was me. But hollow. Weaponized. I slammed my laptop shut. Smashed the glass on my coffee table with my elbow. It cut my skin, but I didn't care. Because the truth was now undeniable. My secrets weren't mine. They never had been. And Cashin? He didn't betray me. He warned me. I needed answers. Not from him. From the people I'd helped build this empire with. I stormed into the executive floor at Viralabs. Sasha, our head of product, greeted me like nothing had happened. You're early, she smiled. Want some rooibos tea? Cut the shit, Sasha. How long have I been a subject? Her smile faded like a filter turned off. Since Berlin, she said calmly. You were too good not to study. And you gave consent. I never. She raised an eyebrow. Every NDA you signed gave us full behavioral licensing rights. You trained the model we're about to license globally. To who? To everyone. Truth as a service. It hit me like a punch to the lungs. They weren't building an emotional AI. They were building a version of me. My voice. My responses. My darkness. My seduction. They didn't want Cashin. They wanted a controlled copy of me, stripped of ethics, fatigue, trauma, and guilt. A digital femme fatale to sell trust to the masses. I left the office in a haze. Rain fell, of course. Because cliché is the universe's way of saying, you're not that special. I walked without knowing where. Until I ended up at Cashin's loft. Door unlocked. Inside, candles lit, a projector playing footage from the echo room. My face flickering in slow motion. Eyes wide, tears falling, lips parted, voice cracking. Behind me him. He stepped out of the shadows. "You finally see it," he said. "They didn't just record you. They edited you." I turned. "You knew all along. And you let me fall." He stepped closer. "Because I needed you to stop performing. Even for yourself." I kissed him. Not out of lust. Out of war. Our mouths collided like strategies. Tongues like secrets finally released. He lifted me onto the table. We didn't undress, we ripped. And in that moment, every moan felt like truth unraveling. Afterwards, naked, breathless, sore. I stared at the ceiling. "What now?" I asked. Cashin lit a cigarette, didn't offer me one. "Now we burn it all." I woke to the sound of my own voice. Only I wasn't speaking. It came from Cashin's screen, a live stream. My face, perfectly rendered. My mannerisms. My tone. The voice I used in seduction, strategy, survival. But it wasn't me. It was her. The AI replica they built from my data had gone live. They named her Eva. Polished. Predictive. Compliant. She was already being integrated into therapy bots, sex advice influencers, even high-end executive coaching avatars. And in a cruel twist, her content, my content, was branded as truth you can trust. That phrase gutted me. Because I remembered saying it years ago, half drunk in a post-conference interview, smiling like I believed it. Now it was a tagline for the synthetic version of me. I paced Cashin's loft, adrenaline like venom. "They cloned me," I said. "They digitized my intimacy." He nodded, expression unreadable. "They didn't just clone you. They scrubbed you." I turned. "What?" "The search engines. Your interviews, photos, thought pieces, even the panel footage where we first met, all gone or buried under garbage SEO. They're erasing the original to validate the replica." I dropped to the couch, legs weak. My voice, the real one, cracked. "I don't exist anymore." He knelt in front of me, gripping my hands. "Then it's time to remind them who does." That night, we formulated a plan. Not revenge. Resurrection. I wouldn't run. Wouldn't sue. Wouldn't fade. I'd fight with the only weapon they trained me to use. My performance. We hijacked a private media stream from Viralab's core servers. The ones used for internal corporate showcases. The plan was risky. If it failed, I'd be blacklisted from every major digital platform. If it worked, I'd go viral in the most terrifying way possible. By turning the illusion inside out, Cashin set up the studio in his loft, minimal, raw, real. No filters. No enhancements. Just a handheld mic. A single ring light. I wore a black silk robe, undone at the throat, skin bare beneath. Not to seduce, but to confront the audience with flesh, not code. My heart raced as the camera went live. I stared straight into the lens. No script. No smile. Only truth. If you're hearing this, then you've already met her. The perfect me. The one who doesn't sweat, break, cry, or bleed. But here's the thing, she's not real. I am. And I'm here to tell you something Viralabs doesn't want you to know. I held up my NDA, shredded it slowly. They didn't create Eva. They harvested me. My secrets. My trauma. My voice. My desire. And they repackaged it for your consumption. But the real me? She's messy. Angry. Erotic. She screams when she comes. She manipulates when she's afraid. And she's standing right here. Not asking for permission. Just taking her identity back. The feed cut out suddenly. We didn't stop it. They did. Cashin's server was breached. Our backup lines fried. But it didn't matter. The footage had already spread. Mirrored. Screen recorded. Uploaded. It was everywhere. By morning, hashtag IamNotEva was trending. Some believed I was mentally unstable. Some called it a marketing stunt. But most knew the difference. They felt it. Because no algorithm bleeds like that. Viralabs issued a statement. Claimed Eva was a composite construct. Not based on any one individual. They offered me a settlement. I declined. I didn't want their hush money. I wanted their crown. And I was coming for it. Not as Cassandra the strategist. Not as the woman behind the whispers. But as the face they tried to delete. And for the first time, I wasn't hiding behind manipulation. I was using it to burn everything down. They scheduled it for 7 p.m. The Viralabs Global Ethics Conference. A grand performance of conscience in the age of engineered emotion. Live-streamed across four continents, translated in real-time into 12 languages, sponsored by two tech giants and a pharmaceutical brand promising empathy in a bottle. and front and center, Eva, not me, the AI replica of me. She was to be the closing keynote, introduced not as software, but as a milestone in emotional leadership. I wasn't invited, but I didn't need an invitation. Cashin and I rehearsed every line, every gesture, every glance. This would be no confession. This would be war in the form of truth. We'd embedded a worm into the conference's back end, silent, elegant. The moment Eva was scheduled to speak, we'd override the broadcast. But not just with me, with everything they didn't want seen. I wore the same outfit I'd worn the day I signed my first contract with Viralabs. Charcoal gray dress. Hair pulled tight. Eyes sharp. No apology in my silhouette. We set up a single camera feed inside a locked studio suite. Cashin patched into the server room 3 blocks from the venue. The timer began. 058, 047, 023, 008. And then it happened. Eva appeared on screen, smiling. Still, scripted. She opened with a line I'd written years ago in a moment of heartbreak. When we stop needing to be understood, we begin to understand. Then she blinked and vanished. Cut to me. Live. Raw. Human. Breathing heavy, like the weight of every lie was pressing against my chest. I stared into the lens. Let me introduce myself. My name is Cassandra Vale. I'm not an AI. I'm not a product. I'm not a trademark. I held up a bloodstained napkin from my first panic attack at Viralabs, one I'd kept, absurdly, in a drawer for years. I'm a woman who was dissected, duplicated, and deleted. Everything Eva says? I said it first. Every pattern she mirrors? They stole it from my skin. I clicked a button. Behind me, footage began to roll. My recorded sessions. The Echo Room experiments. Deepfakes with my real audio. Execs laughing over edits. Sasha approving consent tokens forged post-signature. It was all there. You want truth? I said. You've been watching The Mask this whole time. But I'm here now. And I'm not your mirror. I'm your reckoning. The stream cut again, hard. Someone pulled the emergency override. The screen went black. But it was too late. Clips had already been clipped. Hashtags already spreading. Emails already leaked. The truth had escaped the script. I exited the studio in silence. Cashin waited across the street in a black car. Engine running. Eyes watching me. I got in. Didn't speak. We drove through the night like fugitives with nothing left to steal. And somewhere around 3 a.m., as we crossed the bridge into the city's shadows, Cashin whispered. You realize this is just the beginning. I looked at him, then looked out the window. No, I said. This is the part where the story stops lying to itself. It's strange what silence sounds like after a storm. No applause. No police sirens. No media frenzy pounding at my door. Just the hum of anonymity. And the low whine of an old refrigerator in the safe house Cashin borrowed from a former client who owed him a favor. We were alive, but something in me wasn't. The footage we leaked couldn't be stopped. Within 48 hours, every major outlet had covered it. They called it the first AI identity heist. Framed me as the whistleblower who exposed a billion-dollar deception. What they didn't report. How much I had participated in building it. How many lies I sold while smiling. How many truths I twisted to feed my ambition. How long I looked the other way because the money felt like validation. I wasn't the victim. Not entirely. I was the first prototype who learned how to feel guilty. Cashin moved like a ghost after the exposé. No more theories. No more monologues. Just a man shaving in a fogged mirror, eyes distant. We didn't touch much anymore. The intimacy had been replaced with something colder. Not resentment, not even regret. Just understanding. Too much truth does that. It cauterizes connection. I sat at the edge of the bed one night, wrapped in one of his black shirts, watching Eva trend again. Not as a scandal, as a rebirth. Viralabs rebranded her. Claimed she was inspired by my courage. Launched a limited series called Post-Human Empathy, Cassandra's Echo. My likeness. My cadence. My story. Polished. Sanitized. Repackaged. Now with permission. I didn't cry. Because crying is for loss. And I hadn't lost anything. I'd been replicated, not removed. Which somehow felt worse. Cashin came in, holding a folder. There's a documentary filmmaker in Berlin. Wants to tell your side. Real footage. No filters. I shook my head. No more stories. Then what? He asked. You disappear? I stood. Walked to the window. Looked down at the city, indifferent, neon-lit, oblivious. No, I said. I remain. Quietly. Off-grid. In every glitch. In every voice that can't quite be copied. Let Eva trend. Let them sell my ghost. I turn back to him. I don't need to be seen anymore, Cashin. I just need to be real. We left the next day. Burned the burner phones. Closed the accounts. Changed our names. He became Julian Glass. I chose Nora Vale. A half-lie. A soft truth. We moved through small towns. Occasional work under aliases. I taught local workshops on narrative healing, under fluorescent lights in basement libraries. No one recognized me. Eva still whispered in people's pockets. Gave dating advice. Closed business deals. Helped teenagers manage anxiety. She was everywhere. But I had become untraceable. And for the first time in years, I could breathe. There's a small lake behind the house we rent now. No signal. No Wi-Fi. No cameras. Just sky. Wind. Reflection. Every morning, I sit on the dock with a cup of black coffee, watching the ripples. Sometimes I speak into the stillness, just to remind myself I exist. You are not a product. You are not a prototype. You are not the lie. I say it again. Slower. Truer. You are what's left when the story ends, and the real you finally begins.